emotion is so intact. Your participation won't fail.
Well, hi to the early birds. This is Dave. Welcome, and thank you so much for your kind words and continuing questions. I really appreciate that. And you guys have some really outstanding questions. And we only need to extend this series about 5 more weeks to get to all the answers. And I can tell how much you've thought about this topic. So far, thank you for doing the mute, and when you get ready to talk, unmute star 6 again, and be sure you mute star 6 for our discussion at the beginning and the end. There was a comment we didn't get to last time. Mike had a question and a comment that he's assured me will be very brief to begin our discussion today. So to you, my man.
Hi, Dave. Thanks. You know, we had a little bit of a sidebar after our lecture last week, and one thing that struck me was two things that you talked about. One was identity, and the other one was this notion of the unlived life. And what really struck me about that was how it, you know, Hollywood has kind of co-opted that notion. And made billions and billions of dollars on it over the last, I don't know, 100 years almost. And what it comes down to is Hollywood has created heroes and heroines that have gone, you know, taken this identity that they start out with. And we find them making this transition to their unlived life, their essence. And, you know, we travel with them, whether it be a Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz or a Luke Skywalker or Rocky, you know, that wants to get toe-to-toe in the ring with the champ, or even an Anne Hathaway in Devil Wears Prada, where we have a protagonist that starts out with this limited and limiting identity and then has to go through these baptisms of fire, through these transitions and through, you know, an ultimate ordeal. And when they emerge on the other side of it, they're, you know, either a different person or the same person with new traits, new characteristics, new confidence. And then they actually, they're not done with that at that point. They actually have to then come back into their old world that they left behind as they went on this journey of change. And they have to find themselves again as a changed being in an old world that somehow has changed around them by the time they get back to it. And what I think our role as coaches seems to be is to kind of help our, you know, hero clients, so to speak, get to the other side, you know, guide them along the way, collaborate with them along the way, and help them really, you know, make this transition and grow and, you know, find a way to get to their essence, get to their unlived life. And, you know, just the fact that you have to go through these ordeals and these baptismal fires to get there makes me realize, you know, how easy it would be just to stay in that limited and limiting identity.
I'm going to ask you, because of time, can you summarize the remainder of that in a sentence and get your question into a sentence? And sorry to interrupt you. I love what you're saying.
It's really about, you know, what can we do as coaches? You know, what is it that we can give our clients to give them the inspiration and help them motivate themselves to get to that other side?
Okay, terrific question. First, the motivation is intrinsic. It's built into our minds and our brains, just as the resistance to change is hardwired as well. And we're going to talk about that in just a moment. But all we need to know is how do we convert a period into a comma to look at what's next? Stephen King put this very succinctly on the lines of what you were mentioning about a story. He said all the author ever has to do to keep the reader intrigued is to continue having the reader ask, what's next? So that's all we need to do. The most we need to do with our clients is to look at what's next. So when they have a period, you know, begin to talk about a problem or feel like that's the way things are, or have some external circumstance that seems like a given, then we look at how do we reframe that. Remember we talked last time about how our brains can't recognize the difference between anxiety and excitement. So we frame the what's next instead of going back into the familiar pathway of a problem and danger, better head for cover, which makes it make sense to stop. We look at what's next. What's the opportunity? What's the challenge? And knowing that every step that each client takes is going to be with some uncertainty, some trepidation, because it's new and different. And this is where the collaboration together of doing it together, and we're going to talk in Seminar 3 about a macro system of deconstructing and understanding a story, looking at the algorithms of how we construct a story to know how we can help someone revise and change that story in a simple, stepwise way. Let me give you one example. When someone engages in stopping themselves by some negative self-talk, I'm not confident, I can't do it, I just don't think I can, or I've never done anything like that. Now, they are very familiar with saying that. That hasn't changed. Those negative self-talk comments are a time capsule that probably date back to many decades ago or a few decades ago. So one thing that we can do, and this is the simplest I'll ever be for the remainder of this and the next two seminars, there's a three-step self-directed neuroplasticity, how we can recognize and change our brains. First for us, then for our clients. It's a three-step process. Whenever there's a negative self-talk, recognize it as an error message from your brain, because your brain's doing exactly what it's contracted to do. That's the job description, is to repeat something familiar because it's been hardwired. So it's an anatomical reality. So recognize it as an error message from your brain. Reframe it as a challenge or an opportunity, and then refocus for a specific next positive step, a next best action. So recognize, reframe, and refocus. That's the essence of change. And then we're going to talk about in next seminar how to do that more systematically, but that's as simple as I'll ever get. So what we do in that regard, and the simplest way that we convert a period into a comma, is we ask a question. Because when we give a statement or information or a demand, a directive, an order, then it's about the speaker, it's not about the recipient. The antithesis of that is to ask a question. This is exactly what we do with our clients, because that creates engagement. Here's what happens in the brain. Whenever we give information, and you guys have heard me say this before in different contexts, if information were enough, we'd all have a lot of money saved up, we'd eat mostly vegetables, we'd be thin, and we'd work out every day, and a lot of librarians would be billionaires. So it's not about information, because, you know, people have Google. They wouldn't need to pay us exorbitant fees to do that. So whenever we give information or simply a directive to someone, they will immediately see if it fits with the belief system that's already embedded in their brain. If it does, they'll find ways to confirm it, the confirmation bias applied there, Or if it doesn't fit, they will begin to find ways to refute it. And the more flexible someone is, the more and better they'll refute it. So when you ask a question, it wipes all that off the slate, because when you ask a question, then you have an engagement. You're together looking in the same space for what may be and what's next. So the client, in this case, will begin a response, and then together you collaboratively move ahead. And we want to keep going, a la Stephen King. So what's next? You know, and then look at creating, co-creating a system so that this process is internalized by the client, and they do it on their own in between times, the other 7 days and 24 hours they're not talking to you. So I hope, Mike, that answers your excellent question. Anything else, just briefly, before we move into our content for today? This is partly in response to another question that's sent in, and it relates to ask non-leading questions. Sometimes we ask questions in a way to lead or confirm what we want to hear, or to camouflage a suggestion, because we know how to do it better than the client. If we can just camouflage this suggestion in the form of a question, then maybe we can get away with it. Even if you're in training and Kruger's on the line and you know he's going to comment at the end of this, or you're going to be booted if you send in that to ICF. So we seek data to support what we believe and give inattention or a specific effort to refute what we don't believe. And there have been some recent outstanding studies that show this. If an executive or manager asks, well, when I hear about a problem, or when somebody comes forward and tells me about a problem, those with an open mind seeking full information ask open-ended questions rather than leading ones. So open-ended questions don't lead or express in the question a form of where we want someone to go. So thank you again for all the questions. I'm going to wrap some other comments or questions. I need a management of the background noise. You don't hear the shuffle that you're making, but I'm about to go to lecture mode now, so we'll come back and have some time for discussion in just toward the end. Okay, we're going to talk about how to change mind, brain, and behavior. First question. I'd like you to think about this for just a moment. Why do we resist change, even changing a story that doesn't work? What keeps people from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? Why will someone repeat behavior that doesn't work, often do it harder, and maybe even expect a different result, even if it leads to lower energy or debt or plateaued careers or disappointing relationships? Nassim Taleb in The Black Swan asks the question this way: what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. So I'd also like you to think with me for just a minute the first things to come to your mind. Part of the answer, and this is so I can have another sip of coffee, part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. What do you think about with that statement? We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone, secure and predictable. A comfort zone can be limiting or uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's the default model. We repeat partly because we know how it's going to turn out, and that creates the illusion of effectiveness. Repetition creates the illusion of effectiveness. A new story, on the other hand, generates uncertainty, trepidation. The easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to go back to the familiar, the old story, which usually involves a problem. People fail to change because they don't feel safe changing, because changing means leaving a home base of reality, an internal map they're very familiar with, that we are all familiar with, synonymous with identity. We tend to return to our default mode. Remember this when you're working with each client. They're not trying to oppose or resist you. They're showing you exactly what it's like to be them, exactly what it's like to experience their mind and brain and need to have a collaborative, different way to understand it. So now let's do a brief exercise. Put your palms together and interlock your fingers firmly. Now, notice which thumb is on top. Now, keep your fingers interlocked firmly, exactly the same, but change so that the other thumb is on top. How does that feel? Awkward? Now, move your thumbs back to their original place. Kind of a relief. That's why people don't change or succeed remarkably or derail when they do. They return to their comfort zone. Now, up the ante, add significant success or significant stress, such as a major transition, really beyond a comfort zone. We're going to talk more about comfort zones and how to program change in just a bit. But remember this, there's always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. Keep both in mind because both constitute an empathic appreciation of the client's experience. Now, the other part of that answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. The hypnotherapist Milton Erickson told a story from his childhood in which whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so that he could create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally created a really circuitous path, zigzags and indirect turns, a mischievous little guy. He noticed that each person who followed him followed the same path until the end of the day, the path was well worn despite it being really circuitous. Each person in turn followed the path of least resistance. Not a single person carved a more direct route. And he also noticed, no matter how many twists and turns, and each got a little bit more diabolical, every person in turn followed the path that was created. Not once did a person cut through and get there through a better, faster route. This is how neural pathways are laid down in the brain, by early experiences and then repeated until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous and require way more work. To think creatively, new neural pathways must be developed outside the cycle of usual experience. Stimulation for new insight is a circumstance where the brain can't predict what will happen next. The question that you as a mentor coach asks. The catalyst for insight is a novel stimulation, new information, new context, also you. We're going to talk about this juncture in particular, when your mind and brain both react to leaving the familiar and engaging new behavior. I want you to get back into thinking about your experience now. The uncertainty of this newness can be read as evidence not to proceed, or as intuition of a wrong choice, or more correctly here, as a signpost of change and progress and validation that you're creating a new experience. Discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey. Our brains even have an error detection mechanism located very close to the emotional center that reads, "This isn't normal." When we try something new, this isn't what I expected. Same for change, same for transitions. Now, we'll talk also about how to use this mechanism as part of a powerful internal navigation system. We struggle to embrace change. I mentioned that many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to how the mind and brain work. Neuroscience, quantum physics, strategic coaching, performance science, have a lot to teach us about change and resistance to change. And I want to first talk a little bit about what I believe is the most important variable to determine success for clients, regulating states of mind and developing self-awareness and doing that. Never more important than at a time of change and transition. So let's look at understanding states of mind. A state of mind is a mind-body state. It's like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and process information and how we respond. So a state of mind, that software program, is a set of particular emotions, memories, mental models, behavior patterns. Now, a key element in mentor coaching may be to help a client become aware of first being grounded and centered to have full access to all their states of mind, and then being aware of those various states, which work best for what purpose. Clients can move from a state of mind where they feel stuck or myopic to possibilities. A very simple example is a state of mind of creativity, of creative writing, let's say. A different part of the brain, a different state of the mind than even editing. So it's important to, and I'll give you some examples in the end if we have time, of different ways that people get into different states that are specific for a particular task or performance. Now, here's an illustration, a very simple one, of different software programs in our brain. If you take a rat, put it in a maze, you can teach it to get to the cheese, and it can go again and again. Now, if before you teach the rat or the next rat, you inject it with just a little bit of amphetamine to create a kind of stress-like state, you can teach it to get to the cheese, and it can go again and again. Now, if you take away the amphetamine, the rat can't get to the cheese. It can, in that maze, even though having in a part of its brain the information to get to the cheese, literally die of starvation. Re-inject the amphetamine, it immediately goes to the cheese. State-specific learning and state-dependent memory. Now, this is an example of two distinct states of mind without overlap. It's more an example like post-traumatic stress or where an entire event may be remembered in a particular way. A more common example is try to think of somebody's name and you can't. You know it's on the tip of your tongue, you just can't recall it. You go through the alphabet, you don't have it. Then, in about an hour, you're relaxed and think about it, and boom, it's right there. You've changed into a different state and immediately have access. So this state of mind, each state of mind is a mind-body state with specific software that determines how we perceive and process information and how we respond. We each have a range of states, and with some awareness of which works best for what, how to enter and exit different states. So this is important to recognize, especially because being very grounded and centered allows us access to all of the states of mind, all of the information, and the best creative and integrative synthesis. So here's a mentor coaching application. It's important for us to enter into and hold the mind-body state of the client in order to understand the subjective experience as well as listening at a different level to the story communicated by the client. Developmentally, the right brain communicates emotionally before, way before, the verbal linguistic abilities of the left forebrain. Most of the interactions in a relationship are outside conscious awareness. In a right brain to right brain communication of emotional states and by being grounded and centered of intuitive capacities. This can occur absolutely as well by telephone as it can face-to-face or even possibly video conference because of the distractions there. So once we're tuned into the client, we can receive and resonate with communication in all forms, not just verbal. So then together we can explore experiences, possibilities, brainstorm, and plan. Some very complex versions of the simple question, what happens next? And this resonance can creatively transform the experience into new ideas beyond where the client may have gone before, because you can only envision from your own system. So we allow and create that kind of engagement to hold unexplained experiences, take in emotional communication, ideas, until a recognizable pattern emerges. And notice the kind of listening here. It's not waiting, and I remember this, it's not waiting until the client takes a breath so you can ask them if have they thought about whatever. This is the process of engagement. That change and transition is the result. So a lot will be unexplained and without closure for a while. This requires deep listening and attention simultaneously at multiple levels. It's a way of thinking and a way of experiencing combined. It's the art and science of mentor coaching. So let's look at an example here. How to regulate states of mind. What do these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Kurt Cobain. They never learned the crucial success strategy of regulating their own states of mind using drugs, alcohol, or other addictive substances or process or people to regulate a state of mind and manage emotions can lead to significant compromise. Your state of mind, the particular software program you determine, means that you create the meaning you attach to any stimulus, and the meaning determines your behavior. So a state of mind determines the meaning we attach, the meaning determines the behavior, so by changing a state of mind, you change your behavior. Now, there are two powerful ways to regulate your state of mind, physiology and focus. Physiology is simply relaxation or deep breathing or meditation. Focus is what and how you focus on. And we get what we focus on, not what we want. Focus aligns the energy field of the brain. What we focus on, what we pay attention to, can even determine a state of mind. So this is an illustration of focus. We know that from the simple application in a mindfulness meditation of focusing only on our breath. Breathing in and breathing out. If there's a thought, you let it float away. Same principle in working with a client. Focus on the client. If you notice yourself providing the best answer in the recent history of mentor coaching, refocus on the client and furthering that conversation specifically. So here are a couple of examples of questions. People thought Goliath was too big to hit. David asked, well, if he's that big, how could I miss? Starbucks founder Howard Schultz didn't ask if people wanted to buy a cup of coffee or a latte, but do you want a concept of community, a third place between home and work? Listen to how Steve Jobs convinced, at the time, former president, Pepsi president John Sculley, to become CEO at Apple. They were on a balcony overlooking Central Park in New York City, and Jobs simply asked Sculley, you want to sell sugared water all your life, or you want to change the world? That is what my version of Dutch Uncle mentor coaching would be. So, in discussion, I'm going to give you a case example of a couple of clients asking better questions, but I want to stick to the context right here. Here's an example. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Roger Reed, arrived, his team ranked 217th in free throw percentage, lowest in their division, absolute dead last in their division nationwide. So during practice, Reed had his players develop a mantra, a cue, a focus of physiology. The cue was something just to introduce, to cue the state. So he suggested a couple of dribbles. At the same time, a focus phrase such as relaxed and smooth, and a physiology such as a deep breathing in of relaxation, breathing out any tension. So that's what was happening during those two dribbles. Additionally, in the middle of practice, he'd blow the whistle and have somebody go to the line and shoot two free throws, because in a game, you don't get to line up and shoot 30 free throws and count your best. You're fouled, probably on tilt when you do, and you have to go to the line and shoot. So if they made both, they got to take a breather. If they didn't, they took a couple of laps. In 2 years, their team was number one nationwide in their division. So the cue can be a personal gesture, even a phrase, a phrase like the relaxed and powerful, and a deep breath. So mantras can be used to immediately, once you do this, it hardwires it. Once you do this enough and repeat it, even just the gesture, like before I do a keynote, for example, I'll put together my index finger and thumb, and because I've done that so long and so many times, just to get grounded and centered, I don't need to couple it with a focus phrase or a deep breath. I do that right before every class and every training, and boom, I'm right there. It can rewire your brain. Mantras can calm as well as keep you from overthinking in high-pressure situations. Now, think about this in a little bit broader context, because what I'm talking about is when you repeat something often enough, your brain hardwires it, neural conditioning. What we associate to a stimulus is what determines our behavior. To change your behavior, change your association. Thinking positively isn't enough. You can think positively for a moment, then go back to what's already been established in your brain and the neuronal networks in connection with an emotional trigger. It would be the same effects as trying to change a software program by booting up and talking positively to your computer. The stimulus response is there in your brain, even if you don't believe or know it's there. It's in that time capsule. It's linked. Winston tastes good. Unless you're under 25 years old, what's your association? For 80% of people, it's like a cigarette should. Even if you don't smoke, even if you have a strong belief linking smoking and cancer, even if it's been 30 years since you've heard it, what you link inside your head, the meaning you give, determines your behavior. You can change your behavior when you change the meaning. You can reprogram your associations and rewire your brain. Reprogramming, neuroassociative conditioning, it's a process, not an event. A neural association gets linked or anchored by coupling a strong emotion to whatever's happening around you. This creates a link, and anchors happen when you link emotion. Let's apply that now to mentor coaching. There are two of the strongest forces behind all behavior: the desire to avoid pain, the desire to gain pleasure. To understand the motivating forces of pain and pleasure, the need to avoid pain is biological. It's helped us survive. The brain fights against change to avoid pain on a biological basis because pain and change become equated. And trying to create success by creating more pain usually doesn't work. Playing not to lose doesn't work nearly as well as playing to win. And we can talk about all kinds of studies that show that. But at any moment, the pleasure of eating may feel greater than the pain of overweight. Overweight, not being in shape, that's an abstract notion. That's in the future. Think about it in a more practical sense. We spend 23% more when we use a credit card than when we pay cash or write a check. Overweight, in this first example, is an abstract idea, not the same level of sensory reality as immediate pleasure. So, to influence someone, find out what they're already influenced by, what they link pain and pleasure to. So, one way of looking at this is simply to ask when somebody gets to the point, if they have a plan and don't follow through, they may link some not necessarily conscious but not necessarily unconscious association to proceeding. For example, they may want to generate wealth and create more income, but then they have a plan and get to the plan. It's always a question, do you have a plan? And then don't follow through. All this effort it would take, I'm just as comfortable where I am. I'd have to take advantage of it. People would judge me. I'll be lonely at the top. Or what if I try my very best and still fail? If you're sabotaging success in any area of your life, look at the approach, wanting pleasure, and avoidance, having fear, avoiding pain. The usual focus is, what's going to be the pain if I do this, consciously or unconsciously? The need for focus, and this is where we come in as coaches, what's the greater pain if you don't proceed? What's the greater pleasure if you do proceed? We're defined by the stories we tell ourselves. It's helpful to look at the microsystems, the very specific algorithms that we're using, even the ones that are unconscious, can be made unconscious. The definition, when you become aware of something unconscious, is no longer unconscious. So, which is true? What's the story you want to live? Pick that one. And most people are stuck because of the story they tell themselves. And remember this, the thing that most often keeps you from getting what you want is the story you tell yourself about why you can't have it. So, for any situation, there are three components: state, story, and strategy. State is always the most important, first at least. Whenever a client begins with telling you something that has been upsetting or overwhelming, it's so tempting to want to get into the content because you think you can be really most helpful doing that. The first thing is to resonate with their experience so that you are together in that circle. The stick figure, your client in the circle, the challenge to get in the circle, then you can go somewhere new together. So creating that immediate empathic resonance creates an alliance, a common ground, that you're much more likely to move forward and simply resonate. You know, I hear how upsetting that can be, or, you know, I understand how that would be overwhelming. Something simple. If you're wrong, the client will always correct you, but you're together in that process. Then you can go someplace new. Here's the best supervision I've ever had many years ago when I was still practicing psychoanalysis. And many of you have heard this. I offered an interpretation that I thought was going to be particularly useful for a client, an executive woman, and she paused. And she actually turned around and looked at me in my analytic chair, just to be sure. She said, "No, Kruger, first you've got to be with me before I can go someplace new with you." The most succinct, brilliant supervision I've ever had about this process. State always comes first. That empathic resonance is the foundation for proceeding. So, how do you condition yourself to make changes that last? There are three key elements to neural conditioning. First, identify what to change. You must get to the point where you must change something, change it now, and that you can change it. Must, can, and will change it. And to feel that not changing it would be ultimately more painful than the immediate pain of the change process itself. Believe that things will ultimately bring pleasure. Change can be linked with pleasure. Here are some questions to ask for this step one. If you don't change your pattern, what will be the consequences? What is the pain associated to your current choice that now you've gotten accustomed to? what will be the pleasure with changing? Two, interrupt the existing pattern. Recognize the cues for the behavior so that you can change it immediately. A pattern must be interrupted to change neural conditioning and create a different mindset. The most common mistake is just adding something on to what you already have. Questions for this step. What are the cues or triggers for your automatic pattern that you've just recognized? How can you think of ways to interrupt that pattern once you've identified it? And listen for maybe facilitating a process of getting grounded and centered first. And then perhaps create a new association that can be empowering, like a cue or a trigger. What's the new association? What's the change you want to bring about? And think of the things you gain and the pleasure you'll have with this change. So let's look at mapping mindset for growth. Our minds constantly monitor and interpret to give us a running account of what's happening, what it means, and what to do. That's kind of autopilot. This is how we stay on track or how we get stuck. Mindsets frame an ongoing account of how we interpret, how we process, what we do. Mindsets are powerful beliefs of the stories about ourselves. The mindset that contained the information about how to get to the cheese was state-specific for both of the rats in my previous study. Researchers at Norwegian University of Science and Technology recently discovered that the brain creates multiple independent maps while we proceed with what we do day by day and hour by hour. The human brain operates like a Google map. Rather than one huge map that's all interconnected, we see a situation, it boots up a map of how to deal with that. So, new situation, boom, a new map is booted up, or a familiar map for that kind of situation. This explains how we have different contexts or frames for different situations, and how we have different states of mind or mindset. Now, what this emphasizes is how we need a story to make all of these mindsets and these experiences cohesive and coherent. A mindset is its own software program and system. It's complete. It's internally consistent. The mindset comes first. That determines the meaning you attach to a cue or stimulus. Think about how last evening, for example, you were having a glass of wine, talking to a buddy, a partner. You may have heard something next door in the backyard. You probably didn't even register. Now, tonight, you have just seen the last episode of Clarice, and you hear the same noise in the backyard, and you're on alert, and you have to go check it out. Same stimulus, two different mindsets, two different attributed meanings. To change your behavior, change the meaning you attach. So let's look at fixed versus growth mindset. A simple example is a growth mindset being huge and navigating change and transition. This is what we coach toward with our clients. A growth mindset is based on a belief of change. Maybe our beliefs in the client and in change may have to lead the way, but it doesn't lead the conversation. You believe you can enhance and develop yourself. You become open to accurate information about talents, abilities. Howard Gardner, in his book Extraordinary Minds, concluded that exceptional individuals with growth mindsets have, as he put it, a special talent for identifying their own strengths and weaknesses. I would change that based on the performance sciences of what we know now. It's not about talent. It's about development. The growth mindset of learning is based on a belief that basic qualities are cultivated, develop, and evolve throughout life, that everyone can change and grow through experience and application. You can even change how intelligent you are. On the other hand, those with a fixed mindset, this is what we also focus on in coaching in changing and transforming that process, they try to make sure they succeed. A consuming goal is to prove oneself in classroom, career, relationship. So a fixed mindset can make you preoccupied with how you'll be judged versus growth mindset focused on improvement. So here are some characteristics of a fixed mindset. You can learn things, but you can't change how intelligent you are. You have fixed traits, so success is about proving that you're talented or smart. Problems indicate character flaws. Attempts to repair self-esteem may include assigning blame or making excuses. Now, beliefs are not usually conscious, yet you pay attention to them and hear them. And when you do, and when you do collaboratively with a client, you can address that for transformation also. So we can nudge someone toward a growth mindset. Again, converting a period into a comma. What can we learn from this? What are other possibilities? How can you improve on that? Here's an illustration of the impact of belief and mindsets. In a Yale longitudinal study of senior citizens, those who saw aging as negative and compromised actually physically deteriorated more over a 3-year period. For example, there was a significant drop in the hearing test score equivalent in those 3 years to 8 years of normal aging. Negative feelings about old age can make someone physically age more quickly in areas of hearing, memory, even cardiovascular status. It reduces life expectancy by an average of 7.5 years. A pretty powerful validation of mindset. They lived into the belief that they had or died into it. So, to help clients change behavior, mind, and brain, begin where the client is. Enter that circle, the stick figure of the client, to develop a common ground. Help them learn more about what they already know. Highlight positive attributes, existing neuronal networks. Don't focus on mistakes. Focus will enhance neuronal etching, so why etch further already what's either a mistake or a problem? They've got their problems down. Correct mistaken couplings. Understand and build on existing networks. Let sleeping dogs and old unuseful networks lay. The brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel connections. With every what happens next, there's a small hit of dopamine. That's what keeps people interested in Stephen King's novel and in your work with clients. The client has to recognize and take ownership of experiences. We'll cover more of that as we talk about the roadmap system next seminar. When we write a new story and change our minds, we also change our brains when we repeat that. So give attention to a new experience or new way of doing things consistently and repetitively. Encourage clients to develop their own connection, their own metaphors, to recognize they're the author of their own story. Stories, analogies, and metaphors create maps. So here are some principles then, in summary, of mentor coaching successful changes. We focus on solutions rather than understanding why, on giving the client the catalyst to look at questions, options, and possibilities rather than advice or dictates. Since old patterns are hardwired, it takes consistency of focus on new experiences to change the wiring. The first requirement is claiming ownership of the story, having the point of reference for each story in the author of that story, in the client. Peter Drucker said, the most pressing task is to teach people how to learn. So here are some elements required to mentor successful change. This is a summary of a summary. Concentrate on new behaviors rather than problems in order to create new brain pathways. Co-create new ways of thinking to stimulate brain circuits. This begins new neuronal connections, the fundamentals of beginning new maps. Regulate a state of mind and manage emotion to promote brain power. New insights and adaptations occur through balanced learning, left brain plus right brain, intellectual plus emotional. Facilitate insight rather than give advice. People can usually discriminate between inquiries that prompt insight and attempts at persuasion. Remember the very first component of this seminar: when you tell somebody something, you've lost half of the collaborative possibility already, because they're going to either agree or disagree and then find evidence to support, because they're going to be consistent with their identity, the beliefs, the biases, the patterns, attachment, emotional behavior. Those are all anatomical realities in their brain. Emphasize positive adaptive behaviors and progress. Discourage attention to negative behavior. Facilitate new behaviors to guide the development and actualization of new neuronal maps. At some point, collaboratively conceptualize the mental map, the internal model of the client, in order to facilitate a new level of mastery. This is also that final transformation into the new operating system, the evolving operating system of the client, which we'll call identity. In the event of diversion to an old feeling or behavior, redirect ideas and energy flow to the new ideas. Remember that the power is in the focus, and that permanent change arises from the consistency of that focus. Knowledge conveyed passively is inert. Knowledge generated through insight changes the mind and brain. And finally, remember to conceptualize with the client where they are and what they've done. This is part of the transformation to master and internalize the process. And we'll talk more next time, too. This is the final step of the roadmap, the P, program new identity. This is what makes change permanent. This helps create an outline to incorporate the new experience as a storyline and part of an evolving identity. Okay, remember to manage the background noise. We're in conversation mode. I'm interested in thoughts or questions or things that you'd like to have discussed a bit more. Would anyone launch this by beginning just a very simple sentence of what's the most important thing you're taking away from this seminar? That's often helpful for other people to hear.
Dave, is Eric? It's Eric Jack here with what little voice I have.
Welcome. Go ahead, Eric.
What I think I'll answer the question is, A, I think I understand why my marriage failed. But
okay.
B, I also really think now, in a very clear and interesting way, I figured out how I succeeded post-divorce.
Okay.
In terms of the focus I used to become a coach and to build a brand new business, et cetera, et cetera. You know the story. It's not important here. But hearing...
Can you put that recognition into one... This is going to be your biggest challenge, Eric. You know that, and I know that. Can you put that recognition into one single sentence?
I'm just trying to figure out how to start it.
That's one sentence. You got two now. You got one more.
I'll have to email it to you.
Okay, you know I'm going to read it to everybody. Now, the reason I'm bugging Eric about this, and we haven't talked as a group about this, what we know from the Bible of writing is the four principles of good writing happen to be the same four principles of good speaking: clarity, brevity, simplicity, and humanity. We also know from neuroscience that we remember up to 10 words at a time, and then we begin to tail off with attention and retention. A good buddy of mine at UCLA, at Loyola Marymount, MBA School of Business, did some studies to show that when two groups that were contentious and emotionally charged, like divorce, like mediation, arbitration, when each side agreed to only say 10 words and then shift to the other side, and he had them both, he had each person who spoke hold up both fists and extend one digit for each word, and they had to stop. What he found in each of the groups was they got to a satisfying conclusion in 20 to 30% of the time, and they got to a more successful, satisfying solution doing it this way. So I emphasize that with every coach I train. Ask a simple, clear, brief sentence, and then pause. And if you really want to ask a compound question or a whole bunch of stuff, a paragraph or two, be sure the most important things are in the first 10 to 12 words, because that's when the client is going to stop listening and plan an answer. And if you keep talking, they're going to plan what they have for dinner tonight. So it's important because it's effective, and now we know from neuroscience that it fits with how our minds and brains work. So that's why I'm persnickative about this, and why I gave Eric, who I know can tolerate it, a tough time. Who else? Other? Anyone else dare now to respond? And remember to mute unless you're about to speak. Who else? I wanted to respond to the question from Martina about how to help our clients develop brain muscle to sustain the changes they create for themselves. We've already talked about the answer. To create change that lasts, and this is greatly worded, the brain muscle to sustain, is when this moves to an identity. It becomes part of how and who someone is, because that makes it automatic. That makes it the default mode. So every client you work with, when they take a step forward that's new or different and uncertain, they're going to have some trepidation, some uncertainty. So it may be helpful to keep this in mind to help them reframe that as validation that they're moving ahead, or it's understandable to feel uncertain or not confident. That's a place you get to. Right now, it's tolerating doing things differently and looking at the system of what's next and keeping your eye on the prize. Thoughts, questions, things you like to touch on briefly?
Dave, this is Kip.
Hey, Kip, welcome, man. How you doing?
I'm doing just great, thanks.
Great to have you.
Well, thank you. You had mentioned something earlier about identity being an operational procedure. Could you clarify the notion of identity?
Well, identity is the operating system of how and who we are. It's our true north that we've encompassed. You know, your identity. Let's say someone who has an identity as a survivor or a leader, someone who has an identity of having since 1977 always driven a BMW. Those are all forms of identity. If we depart from it, that's just who we are. We don't have to think about it. You know, I'm a farmer and rancher at heart. And that's a part of who I am, just like, you know, My eyes are blue. So we always return to our identity. The key in coaching, as you know, whenever we help a client create a change in behavior, we want to listen for how we can help that person incorporate that as a new model gradually into an operating system, because if it's just left, and I need to mute a background noise because there's noise that you're not hearing that's being picked up. I like to stay on discussion mode. Whenever that becomes just a change in behavior, they'll revert back to their true identity. That change won't last. The way the change lasts is to make it part of how and who we are. Think about the transformational experience, for example, of being a dad, of being a mom. That forever changed you. That was a change and a transformation. You'll always be a mom or dad. You don't leave that or depart from it. You may have a lot of other things in the foreground, but that's part of an identity. And we're going to talk, and Kip, you know the roadmap system that we're going to talk about next time, because that's simply a way to understand the algorithms of how we put together stories. And the last is how we help someone transform how and who they are throughout the coaching, by highlighting that, by discussing it, so that they get it, that that's an evolved experience. It's not something they're just doing to try out new behavior. That's who they are now. And we'll talk about some practical ways to go about that. Kip, for right now, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Okay. All right, super. And I'll bet you have some good examples of how you've helped clients transform their identity. I'll take 30 seconds extra if you have an illustration of that. Can you just succinctly do that in a sentence or two if something comes to mind?
Yeah, a client of mine was in a lot of despair because they couldn't change some habits that were very toxic, and so they focused on where that stress was in their body, and I asked them what it was that they experienced, and they told me it was pretty, it was suffering, as you mentioned earlier, and then I asked them, well, how would you rather feel, and or what's your body telling you that you need, and then it just emerged into a hopefulness, and so there's something about staying with the story that's uncomfortable enough to ask, what would you rather feel? What's different than that? And when the body was involved with it, it just seems to emerge from an impasse into, or a sterile void into a fertile void. So, but I was willing to stay with it with them long enough for that to emerge.
That's a great illustration of bringing about a synthesized mind, brain, body, spirit experience into the present of what's next and the intrinsic reward of that. So you have that as an experience to refer to. They do most especially, and that's transformed. That's a transformative step in how and who they are that can be relied on next time to build on, and that's what we pay attention to as coaches, to look at how we can build on that and evolve that identity, not just as an event, but as a part of how and who they are now, of an operating model. So thanks all of you very much again. Thanks for all the communication that you've sent. I appreciate it and look forward to picking up right here next time. I'll do a preface for the roadmap, so look at the outline at least for the first page or two of the roadmap, because I'll want to do a preface before we move into that while we're in discussion mode, I'm hoping. Thanks very much. Have a great rest of the week. Take good care of yourselves. See you.